What next for Saudi Arabia and Iran today on The World? I'm Marco Werman. Saudi Arabia is in a major spat with Iran. Some say it's down to the divide between Sunni and Shiite Muslims. Others say it's politics.
You have two great powers in the region that want to achieve dominance. And sectarianism is a very powerful tool in getting legitimacy for their quest for power.
Plus, a fence goes up between Sweden and Denmark, but it's unlikely to stem the flow of migrants.
It's something that you could probably climb over yourself.
And introducing a new member of the periodic table.
Euunioctium, which is essentially a kind of placeholder name that means 118th element.
Those stories coming up today on The World. Glad you could be with us on this first Monday of 2016. The world we hear is getting smaller, the universe expanding, and today we also hear about four freshly recognized elements in the periodic table, so fresh they don't even have names yet. More on that later in the show. We begin, though, with a closer look at the bad chemistry that's got the Middle East and much of the world on high alert right now, Saudi Arabia and Iran, two nations that also claim religious leadership roles, Saudi Arabia for Sunni Muslims, Iran for Shiite Muslims. Relations between the two were already tense. Then this weekend, Saudi Arabia executed 47 people, including a prominent Shiite cleric. Next, a Saudi embassy in Iran was attacked by protesters there, and the Saudis decided to sever diplomatic relations with Iran. For the Saudi View, we turn to Fahad Nazer, formerly with the Saudi embassy in the U.S. He's now an analyst with the Arab Gulf States Institute in Washington, which is funded by Saudi Arabia, and a think tank in Abu Dhabi.
From the Saudi perspective, the people who were executed on Saturday were essentially the worst of the worst. They were tried and convicted of some very serious terrorist attacks, in which about 100 people have been killed. Some of these attacks go back to 2003. They basically targeted Saudis, both civilians as well as security personnel, but also some Brits and Americans. They had already gone through several appeals processes and exhausted basically all the legal measures within the legal system. And 2015, I think, was an especially brutal year in Saudi Arabia in terms of the terrorist attacks that took place. Those were mostly inspired by ISIS. The ISIS sympathizers and affiliates in some ways pose a serious challenge, I think, to Saudi security. And so in the way I'm reading it, these executions were a message to Saudi Arabia's own militants, whether they're Sunni or Shiites, that going forward, Saudi Arabia will have a zero-tolerance policy. You cannot conduct violent attacks against Saudis or non-Saudis, no matter what your grievances are.
So if you believe the bloodiest attacks of 2015 were because of ISIS, why go after Shia activists? I mean, the cleric Nimr al-Nimr always claimed he fought a war of words, not a war of violence.
Well, at the very least, I think one has to realize or admit that he was considered a firebrand, at the very least. His sermons were very fiery and in some ways, on multiple occasions, he essentially called for the overthrow of the Saudi government. I don't think he was implying that that should be done peacefully. And in terms of the actual crimes that he was charged with, it was certainly not for his activism, as is portrayed sometimes in the Western media, that the Saudi government accused him of actually taking part in a terrorist cell and in fomenting sedition and in causing people to actually carry out actual attacks. And they held him personally responsible for some of the attacks in which security personnel were killed. And incidentally, there was another person by the name of Faras al-Shuwail, who was a Sunni militant, who was also executed on Saturday. And he, too, was considered as an ideologue who incited people to violence. And he and Nimr were essentially held personally responsible for some of the deaths that took place.
You know, Shiite protesters have taken to the streets from Bahrain to Pakistan. The Saudi embassy in Iran came under attack. Thousands of protesters today in Baghdad. Do you think the Saudis kind of knew what was going to be the response to these executions?
That's hard to tell. I mean, again, I think the primary message here was towards its own you know, Sunni and Shia militants within Saudi Arabia. I suspect that they anticipate that there would be some sort of reaction. But in the press conference that was held yesterday in Riyadh by the Saudi foreign minister, he made it very clear that the statements that came from specifically from Iran, from its top religious and political leaders, were unacceptable and were tantamount to unacceptable interference in the domestic policies of Saudi Arabia. And he also said that they let American officials understand that, as far as they're concerned, the judiciary in Saudi Arabia is an independent institution and that they reject any outside criticism questioning the judiciary's decisions.
That was the Saudi view from Fahad Nazar, formerly with the Saudi embassy in Washington. As he mentioned, to the Saudis, this Shiite cleric who was executed was the worst of the worst. But my colleague with BBC Persian, Majid Afshar, says that's not how some hardliners in Iran see it. You see, Sheikh Nimr al-Nimr had close ties with Iran, even studied there for a couple of years. And the view from Tehran is that, Majid Afshar says, he was unjustly targeted.
The Iranian line is that this man was just a political prisoner. He had his ideas and he was never involved in terrorist acts. As human rights groups have said, this man, Sheikh Nimr al-Nimr, never received a fair trial. And Saudi Arabia failed to provide a substantive evidence on what specifically this sheikh has been accused of. They just confined it to accusations of being related to terror acts.
Following these executions in Saudi Arabia, there were protests around the globe and an attack on the Saudi mission in Tehran. What has been the reaction from the Iranian government about that attack?
When the gatherings happened outside the Saudi embassy in Tehran and also the consulate in Mashhad in northeast of Iran, no one thought that it could get so ugly and these people would be allowed to enter the embassy. And the government, I think, in the very beginning, didn't take it as seriously as they should have. We know that the Iranian government is now quite unhappy. Even the most conservative elements and groups inside Iran have now condemned the ransacking of the embassy, and they say they're not happy about Saudi Arabia's reaction to this, which they called hasty and uncalculated.
You mean severing diplomatic ties with Tehran?
Severing diplomatic ties, exactly, yes.
What have you been hearing from everyday Iranians? How do they feel about the fallout between Iran and Saudi Arabia? Do they support the actions of those hardliners who attacked the Saudi mission? I mean, where are their heads at?
We've been having quite mixed reactions to this. You know that differences between Saudi Arabia and Iran, these are historical differences. And some people were quite happy. We've got some comments on our website and on our Facebook page. There are people who say they're so happy that Iranian people would not have to go to Hajj anymore because they think that with severing of ties would lead to the Iranian side not sending pilgrims to Saudi Arabia, and they're happy about that. But at the same time, we are getting loads of comments saying the cutting off of diplomatic ties between Iran and Saudi Arabia would somehow empower groups, extremist groups like ISIS in the region.
Now, you mentioned the Iranians who say, fine, with severed diplomatic relations, they don't have to go to the Hajj anymore in Saudi Arabia, Mecca and Medina being those destinations. I mean, there were a couple of hundred Iranians who died in the Hajj stampede back in September. And yes, it was an accident. Yes, Iranians were deeply upset, but it didn't cause a reaction as big as this one. Why do you think that is?
With the death of Iranian pilgrims in Saudi Arabia, the reactions of Iranian authorities and the Iranian leader, although it was quite negative and it was quite strong, but still the Iranian leader did not come out and talk about vengeance. But with this one, the Iranian leader said that there would be a divine vengeance on the death of or execution of Sheikh Nimr al-Nimr. And that gave the conservatives and the hardliners in Iran an excuse to gather outside the embassies. And then they took pictures of themselves and posted it online and put it online, apparently thinking that they will be rewarded for this. But now we are hearing the Iranian police saying that they have arrested 50 of those people who attacked the embassy. And now we're seeing the Iranian government, especially President Rouhani, who now sees his government being undermined by the conservatives, coming out and condemning the attacks as uncalculated and wrong.
Majid Afshar with the BBC's Persian service there, speaking with us from London. The deep rift between Iran and Saudi Arabia includes religion as well as politics. Vali Nasser has been writing about this for much of his career. He's currently dean of the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies in Washington.
Iran is a predominantly Shia country, which is a sect of Islam that is different from the one that is followed by the majority of Muslims who are Sunnis. And Saudi Arabia is a predominantly Sunni country. So each of them see themselves as the protector and spokesman of these two sects of Islam. And in that capacity, also see themselves as rivals for leadership in the Islamic world.
So briefly, what is the difference between the Sunni version of Islam and the Shia version? And those differences, I know, they go back to like 632 AD after the death of the Prophet Muhammad. Do we have to go back that far to understand the split?
Well, historically, yes. But in reality, this is like a divide between Protestants and Catholics in Christianity. The origins are very old in history, but they also are about modern day political identity. And in a region of the world where religion matters enormously, then what form of religion do you follow becomes very important. So in some ways, Shia and Sunni today operate as a sort of a proxy for ethnic identity. It defines who you are. Are you part of majority? Are you part of minority in a country? And therefore, this is a theological difference, but one which has a great deal of contemporary political relevance.
Yeah, let's talk about how great a deal it has. Most Muslim countries in the world, our listeners should know, are Sunni. Iran and Iraq are two of the notable exceptions. What role does religion play in this Cold War between Shiite Iran and Sunni Saudi Arabia? And how do the rulers play out the differences?
Well, first of all, it's true that the Shiites are an absolute minority in the larger Muslim world. But in the heart of the Middle East, where the current crises are unfolding, the numbers are much closer to one another. Mm. And we've gone since the American invasion of Iraq, which handed over a previously Sunni ruling regime, Sunni ruling country to the Shias, what we've had in the region is a gradual shift of power away from Sunnis in the direction of the Shias. And this has proven to be a very turbulent process. So countries like Saudi Arabia and many Sunnis on the ground feel that Iran is rising. Iraq is now Shia. There is restlessness among Shias in Bahrain or in Saudi Arabia and Kuwait. And they have a sense of siege, and they're reacting to that.
Vali Nasser, you studied this for decades. Where do you see all of this heading, especially with these executions?
Well, I think now we have a major rupture in the region, which is that the Saudis have ended diplomatic relations with Iran and have encouraged many of their allies to do so. That would make it much more difficult to have a region-wide solution to Syria, to Iraq, to ISIS, to Yemen. So we're in for a period of a greater freeze in what was already an ongoing Cold War. It will require a lot of effort on the part of the U.S. and its European allies to lean on both sides. And this also includes the Russians and the Chinese, who also have a stake in the Middle East as well, to get the two sides to go back at least to where they were before the executions, and then basically lean on them that they would not take any more provocative actions of the kind that we saw over the weekend.
Are there activists who seek a unification of Shia and Sunni Islam, and do they even matter if governments want to use...
This is not an ecumenical problem. You have two governments that are engaged in a very classic realpolitik. If you really want to understand the Middle East, you don't need to go 1,400 years back to understand Shia-Sunni divide. You can look at the history of Franco-German rivalry in Europe or English-French rivalry in Europe. You have two great powers in the region that want to achieve dominance. And sectarianism is a very powerful tool in getting legitimacy for their quest for power.
Vali Nasser at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies in Washington, thank you, as always.
Thank you.
Four new elements in the periodic table need names, and right now all they get are numbers. That's coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. There's been a big break in a case in Israel that made headlines all over the globe last summer. You may remember it. An arson attack in the West Bank that killed a Palestinian toddler. A few weeks later, his parents also died from their injuries in that fire. It's a region that's known for frequent violence, but this incident stood out. It also helped to fuel a wave of Israeli-Palestinian violence that continues. The break in the case happened yesterday. Israel indicted two Jewish extremists, a 21-year-old Israeli man who's now facing murder charges, and an unnamed minor charged as an accomplice. We've got correspondent Daniel Estrin on the line from Jerusalem to fill us in. First, Daniel, tell us about the suspects who've been charged.
The main suspect is, as you said, a 21-year-old Israeli. His name is Amiram Ben Uliel. Another suspect, a minor, was supposed to help him, the main suspect, carry out the attack. He didn't show up in the end, and so, according to the indictment, Amiram Ben Uliel carried it out himself, confessed under interrogation. He told prosecutors, according to the indictment, that he did it to avenge a Palestinian shooting in the West Bank that killed a young Israeli settler, a university student. And prosecutors say that he picked the village, he purposely looked for homes where people were sleeping inside, and threw the firebomb inside.
How did officials catch their break in this case? I mean, lots of investigation for months.
What really cracked it was, according to the suspect's lawyers, confessions extracted under torture. The suspects were held for many days by Israeli interrogators, and when they were finally allowed to meet with their lawyers, they told their lawyers that they were tortured under interrogation. And there have been major protests in the streets here, hundreds of settlers and right-wing supporters protesting against these allegations of torture. These are similar allegations to what Palestinians have claimed they've gone through under interrogation for years. Now, there's a gag order now on what Israeli interrogators actually did during those interrogations, and the security agency responsible says it's not going to reveal its methods. But Israeli law does allow for certain kinds of physical tactics under interrogation in extraordinary cases. And this has already become, and it's going to continue to be, a huge topic of debate here in Israel, the treatment of detainees under interrogation.
Now, Israel's domestic security agency, Shin Bet, has said that the main suspect in the arson attack is part of a Jewish group that, frankly, sounds pretty extreme. This group supposedly had more attacks planned on Palestinian as well as Christian targets. What do you know about this group?
The Israeli authorities call the group the Rebellion. They say that's what the group calls themselves, and that the man at the head of the group is a young Jewish settler activist who is the grandson of Rabbi Meir Kahana, who is the godfather of what you might call militant Judaism. He's the late ultranationalist rabbi born in Brooklyn. His political party in Israel is still banned for calling to expel all Arabs from Israel. And this this new group, the Rebellion, does not recognize the authority of Israeli courts. They don't recognize Israeli secular democracy. They want to see Israeli rule replaced with theocracy and rule under Jewish law. It sees violence against Palestinians as a way to create chaos that brings about this sort of new Jewish order in Israel. And all of this is according to Israeli prosecutors and the Israeli security agencies. It's the fringe of the fringe of extremist Jews. And what we know about the main suspect in this firebombing case is that in the past he did express that he does not recognize the authority of Israeli law, and that he has in the past been associated with the so-called head of this rebellion group.
Mm. Daniel Estrin in Jerusalem often joins us to talk about Israel in the Mideast. Daniel, thanks a lot.
You're welcome, Marco.
For anyone studying chemistry, there's big news. Four new entrants to the periodic table. If you can't remember that far back, the periodic table is that cool chart in science class that displays all the known chemical elements, hydrogen being number one. These four new elements are man-made and highly unstable, and they don't really have names yet. I asked Andrea Sella about that. He's a chemistry professor at University College London.
Well, at the moment, they have some provisional names that are really quite unpronounceable. I mean, they're things like euunioctium, which is essentially a kind of placeholder name that means 118th element in the list. And so having really confirmed that these things exist, now the task is to figure out some nice sort of fun names that are actually memorable.
So I was always curious when I was in school, like how did Einsteinium get its name and Californium? I guess they're obvious, but how do you come up with a name for these four new elements?
In recent years, there's actually been, you know, a formal system that has been set up to actually come up with names. And so there's quite a bit of horse trading. But, I mean, traditionally, the names of elements have either been associated either with people or with places or perhaps with some figure from Greek mythology, you know, tantalum or niobium or promethium. Promethium after Prometheus, the man who stole the sacred fire. And promethium turns out to be a particularly disagreeable radioactive element that really kind of symbolizes, in a sense, you know, the attempt to tame the atom.
I don't know if you've got a special relationship with any of these four new elements, Professor Sella, but do you have a name that you'd like to see one of them get?
Oh, yes. I mean, I have a number of candidates. One, for example, I think might be Daltonium. And John Dalton was the English chemist who really revived at the beginning of the 19th century the idea of the atom. And I think it would be nice to celebrate him. A second name that I think one ought to consider is actually Ramseyum. Hmm. And that would be for element 118. And that's celebrating William Ramsey, the man who discovered all of the elements above 118, helium, neon, argon, krypton, and xenon, the noble gases. And I think it might be nice to celebrate him.
Why do you think it's important to have the right name with the right element?
When you don't know what something is called, it's very hard to pick it up and look at it. It's a strange thing. If you go out bird watching, I mean, most people will kind of look out there and go, well, you know, they're all little brown things. But if you've actually got an ornithologist, a bird watcher who actually knows what he's doing, then he'll be able to tell you that it's not just a little brown job. Oh, you know, take a look. That's, you know, this kind of warbler or that sort of sparrow. And suddenly that brings the whole thing alive and you'll never look on those birds in quite the same way again. And I think it's very important, actually, to have names for things because that gives them an individuality and makes it possible for us mentally to distinguish one from the other.
Given how big these projects are, does anyone ever suggest the mediocre way out, an acronym of the parties involved?
Yes, I'm sure that some kind of compromise might come out. But actually, there's a lack of romance about that. I mean, I actually think that it would be nice perhaps to go back to some of those delightfully named elements like praseodymium and neodymium, the green and the new twins, for example, that were discovered in the sort of 1880s or thereabouts. You know, naming things is always tricky, and you know, the person who names it, you know, has a sense of pride. Who knows what they will come up with?
Andrea Sella, chemist at University College London. Thank you very much.
Pleasure.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. The Soviets pioneered a female cosmonaut program.
Since childhood, I've been dreaming about space, about spaceships.
And this Russian scientist says it's time to revive it.
We need to implement women into this space industry to let them fly.
That story's ahead, right here on The World.
The World is brought to you by Public Radio International with support from TIAA CREF, a global financial company that's created to serve and built to perform. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. For decades, travel between Denmark and Sweden has been super easy. No border identity checks between the two countries, both members of the European Union. But after the arrival of record numbers of refugees and migrants last year, things are changing. Now Denmark and Sweden have both reintroduced border controls, and it is a big deal. Maddie Savage is an editor in Sweden for The Local, an English-language news outlet.
It's the first time
in 50 years that people traveling between Sweden and Denmark are going to be subject to these kind of compulsory identity checks. And so what this really changes is some of the freedom of movement in the European Union. Every single person trying to make the journey between the two countries over the famous Öresund Bridge now has to get off the train at Copenhagen Airport, go up a flight of stairs, have their identity documents checked, then get back down onto the platform and wait for the next train. And this is all designed as part of efforts to try and limit the number of refugees seeking asylum in Sweden.
Right. Now, that bridge you just were talking about, that connects the city of Copenhagen in Denmark with the Swedish city of Malmö. So that bridge is actually an international border, right?
It's an international border. It's incredibly iconic. It's been made even more famous in recent years due to the Scandinavian drama, The Bridge, which is about two detectives working on either side of the bridge. But really importantly, this is also something that's going to affect commuters in the region. There's about 8,600 people who every single day cross that bridge to go to work, either to work in Copenhagen when they actually live in Sweden, or to work in Malmö, the Swedish city, when they actually live in Copenhagen. It doesn't take long. It normally takes about 40 minutes. But for these people, these extra checks are going to add at least an extra 30 minutes to their journey.
Whose idea was the fence and the ID checks? Did Sweden and Denmark have to agree together? Or is this a pan-European thing?
It's incredibly controversial. This is an initiative that's come entirely from Sweden. Sweden was one of the countries that took in record numbers of refugees in 2015, some 163,000 people. Denmark, by contrast, took in around 18,000. So that shows you the very different immigration policies of the two countries. Sweden then said at the end of last year that it was struggling to take in as many refugees. It was running out of accommodation and therefore decided to introduce these much tighter border checks. But what's interesting is that Denmark has turned around today and said that it's going to actually tighten checks on its border with Germany, and has said that that is a direct result of what's been happening in Sweden, because it wants to continue to limit the number of people that are getting into Denmark as well.
How do Swedes feel about all this, given their kind of reputation as being one of the most welcoming countries to new migrants?
Again, that's something that's really starting to dominate debates here. I mean, yes, Sweden has this global reputation of tolerance and openness, and as I say, took in record numbers of asylum seekers in 2014 and in 2015. But opinion polls are showing that there is support for cutting the number of residency permits. The majority of Swedes are still in favour of helping refugees and helping asylum seekers. But the tide is starting to turn. Support is also rising for the very anti-immigration Sweden Democrat Party. It's a far-right party. It got 12.9% in the last election. So I think although a lot of Swedes do want to maintain that reputation, there are also an awful lot of others that are glad that tighter border checks are being introduced.
So the new ID controls and fence, if they do affect people's migration plans, where will these Sweden-bound migrants go instead?
Well, I think it remains the case that refugees will try and travel to Sweden. Firstly, because Sweden, until very recently, offered permanent residency to all asylum seekers from Syria, there are a lot of people with friends and family in the region, so they want to come and join their friends. There's also generous social security benefits for people. So I think it's going to be very interesting to follow what happens now.
Maddie Savage there, editor with The Local in Sweden. An estimated 1 million refugees and migrants arrived in Europe in 2015. Most of them were fleeing wars in Syria, Iraq, and Afghanistan. Nadra Aboud is part of that group, but this was not the first time she had to abandon her home. That was almost 70 years ago, as Rebecca Collard found out when she met Nadra on a bus near the Serbian-Hungarian border.
When Nadra Aboud left her home in Nazareth, she took just a small bag with a few key things. I had a homework assignment to do, so I brought my book, she says. It was 1948, and the newly declared state of Israel was at war with its neighbors. Nadra's father thought it was better to head north for a few days and wait for the fighting to blow over. Nadra was 9 years old. The family crossed into Syria and waited. We were sure we were going back, says Nadra. My mom told me I would be returning to my school soon. They were so sure Nadra's parents didn't enroll her in school in Syria. She'd be back home soon and could return to class. But the years passed. Her family found shelter in the Yarmouk refugee camp on the outskirts of Damascus. Nadra put her books in a box. They built a concrete home, but the Abouds kept the key to their house in Nazareth. It was a big house, Nadra says, remembering her home in Nazareth. Two floors, made of stone. By the time Nadra got married in the 1960s, Yarmouk had grown into a busy neighborhood, housing thousands of Palestinian refugees. Then, in December 2012, Syria's civil war came to their neighborhood. Rockets hit near their home. I had to get my husband to the hospital because he got shrapnel in his head, Nadra says. So we went to one in Damascus. But when they tried to return to Yarmouk, they found the road closed. We had nothing at all, says Nadra. No money, nothing. They headed to the Syrian city of Al-Hami. But wherever we go, the bombing would follow us, says Nadra. They finally made it to Istanbul. Her husband died there in hospital. The family waited in Turkey, but there was no future for them. In September, they decided to join the tens of thousands of refugees heading toward Western Europe. Mona is Nadra's daughter. We had no official papers, no residency, and no future. Nothing, says Mona, of their time in Turkey. If we go to a European country, we'll get official papers, even citizenship. When I meet Nadra and her family on the Serbian-Hungarian border, they are in a crowded bus heading toward yet another camp. She's already crossed from Turkey to Greece by boat and traveled by foot, wheelchair and taxi up through the Balkans. She holds the travel document issued to her by the Syrian government. It's the closest thing she's ever had to a passport or citizenship. You know, we have no house, no nation. Where should we go? Wherever we go, the war follows us, she says. We heard good things about Germany. A week later, I get a voice message. Nadra has made it to Germany. She's again in a camp, but she laughs and tells me to come visit. When I call her back, Nadra tells me the family is now sharing a room near Warstein, Germany. Soon they hope to move to an apartment with more space. Nadra says she's happy, but that she still thinks often about Nazareth and their big two-story stone house. They are safe. The war is now far away. But for Nadra and the Abud family, Germany represents more than just safety. It represents their first chance to be something more than refugees, to become citizens of a state. For the world, I'm Rebecca Collard.
If you're looking for a new job in 2016 and you like weightlessness, NASA is hiring. Through February, the space agency is taking applications for astronaut candidates for the first time since 2012, and is hoping more women will join the ranks. Right now, only a quarter of NASA's astronauts are female. Meanwhile, the world's second largest space program, Russia's, lags far behind NASA in terms of women, but Russia may be trying to catch up, as Charles Maines reports from Moscow.
Deep space travel is kind of a Russian specialty, at least the simulated kind. The Russian Space Agency has been simulating the effects of deep space on its cosmonauts since the 1960s. But so far, only one simulation, in the year 2000, had a mixed-gender crew, and it didn't go well. A fight broke out among male crew members after one tried to steal a kiss from his female crewmate. Things went much better last fall at Moscow's Institute for Biomedical Problems. That was the site of Moon 2015, an isolation experiment to test the effects of long-distance space travel. This time, the crew was all women, the first experiment of its kind, its organizers claim. The six Russian women aboard underwent 8 days of simulated spaceflight in a mock space capsule about the size of a shipping container. The eighth day was tacked on while they were in the capsule to test their reactions to stress. And who knows, maybe the bank of cameras and microphones facing them was part of the experiment too, as they returned to Earth. One by one, the volunteer cosmonauts emerged from the capsule's hatch wearing red flight suits. The women, in fact scientists in their 20s and early 30s, saluted their superiors before being presented with flowers. Now, flowers, that's just Russian tradition. But in the run-up to the experiment, Russian media also asked how they could manage on board without men, without makeup, shampoo, and cell phones. A promo video by the Institute showing the women posing for selfies didn't really help matters. But an all-female crew actually has a big advantage when it comes to deep space travels, says Sergei Ponomarev, the scientific director of the Russian Moon 2015 experiment.
What we have seen from the project that all the women worked entirely in one team. They had no conflicts. This is a really very good crew. Of course, after some training, this crew is able to go to Moon, to ISS, to Mars, to other points, and to do their work perfectly well.
Of course, I did not hesitate and I joined this experiment because it was a really great chance for me.
Daria Komisarova, a senior researcher on the mission, said the experience inside the capsule was an overwhelmingly positive one, and it reaffirmed some old aspirations.
Since childhood, I've been dreaming about space, about spaceships, but for me it was a very distant dream. But now I think that maybe it is worth trying. And I think that in Russia we need to implement women into this space industry, to let them fly.
Traditionally, women have had an iconic place in the space program here, one in particular. In 1963, Soviet cosmonaut Valentina Tereshkova launched into orbit under the call name Chaika, the Seagull. She became the first woman in space. Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev seized the moment for what it was, a propaganda coup. Later, he appeared with Tereshkova on Red Square, where he chastised the U.S. for discrimination against women in the space race.
Буржуазная общественность всегда подчеркивает, что женщина – это слабый пол.
The bourgeoisie always claimed that women are the weaker sex, Khrushchev proclaimed. Look at what our Soviet woman has shown to America's male astronauts. She's shown them who is who.
На штурм космоса выходит советская женщина.
Tereshkova joked that with women now storming the cosmos, the world's male cosmonauts wouldn't quite be so lonely. But it was 19 years before the Soviets sent another woman into space. A planned all-female voyage in 1985 was tabled over technical and later funding issues. And in the post-Soviet era, only two more Russian women have been in orbit. The Moon 2015 experiment isn't likely to change all that in the short run, but it does come amid an effort by Russia to reestablish supremacy in the cosmos.
Сейчас необходимо поддержать сформированные заделы.
President Vladimir Putin has authorized an ambitious new space exploration plan, and the Russian Federal Space Agency, Roscosmos, is already constructing a new generation of spacecraft to make a manned mission to the moon in 2029. While the crews of that mission won't be known for some time, Moon 2015 flight commander Yelena Luchitskaya says she hopes their experiment will help the next generation of women cosmonauts secure their fair share of tickets for the ride.
Это должно быть в равной степени принадлежать как мужчинам, так и женщинам.
There should be equal spaces made for men and women, particularly on deep space missions, Luchitskaya says. I hope things will change and that our experiment gives a small push to show that women are ready to handle these situations no worse than men. In fact, good enough to go where no woman has gone before. For The World, I'm Charles Maines in Moscow.
By the way, you can see the women cosmonauts over at PRI.org. Penka Kuneva has gone where no woman has gone before. I say that with a high level of confidence, not with fact, but I'm almost 100% certain no woman musician has composed a classical work around the concept of women astronauts. Penka Kuneva from Sofia, Bulgaria has. It's titled The Woman Astronaut and came out last year. Penka Kuneva scores music for films like The Matrix and Transformers. She's also done music for video games like Prince of Persia, but it was her own career path as a composer from Eastern Europe where she saw parallels with her handful of astronaut sisters, ambitious women in an unusual profession, tackling themes like perseverance, hope, and destiny. Here's more from Kuneva's The Woman Astronaut from the third movement called Space. This is Goodbyes in Zero Gravity. Thank you. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Hossein Darakhshan was known as the Iranian blog father, and as one of the first bloggers in Iran, he was often critical of the regime. Then he seemed to change political stripes, becoming more sympathetic toward the regime. Still, in 2008, he was sentenced to 20 years in jail for his online writing. He ended up spending 6 years in one of Iran's worst prisons before his release in 2014. When we spoke recently, Darakhshan told me about his line of defense during the trial.
My whole argument was that you're not putting me on trial. You're putting the person I was 10 years ago or 8 years ago. And I've changed a lot. I have become much more rational towards how the position of Iran and even the Islamic Republic is in the world now. And I'm not as critical and radical as I used to be. And you can see all that in my writings. And I hoped that it would be considered, but apparently it wasn't in the beginning. In the court, it wasn't. In the verdict, it wasn't. But gradually, I think they understood that I was honest. And this is how I was pardoned.
What was it like for you when you heard the news that they were going to let you out?
I was hoping for it for a long time, but I didn't believe that it was coming realistically.
I mean, your sentence was originally was for 20 years. So after six years, it must have been.
It was very surprising because I was imagining maybe that they would allow me to be on furloughs, long furloughs. But I wasn't expecting all the sentence to be suddenly disappeared and I would be pardoned completely. And everyone who is in that situation, I think, would feel shocked for a while and it would be difficult to readjust yourself to the new situation.
Yeah, tell me about your first impressions of seeing the outside world, of seeing Tehran after 6 years in Evin prison. What really struck you about the city?
Tehran had changed a lot in terms of its looks, especially. I mean, there is a lot of real estate development, especially north of Tehran, where price for land has increased so rapidly and so exponentially. And I think this is the most striking change you would realize when you see all these new condominiums and all these high-rise, very luxurious apartment complexes. And then there is also many, many SUVs and expensive cars, especially, again, in north of Tehran.
What about the tech changes, especially for someone like you, a blogger? You get out of 6 years of prison. It's 2014 suddenly, and people are like, you're a blogger? What's that?
The biggest change, I think, was the emergence and the unbelievable, incredible popularity of smartphones. This was very new to me. Everyone had them, was holding them, using them all the time on the subway, on taxis, on the street, even in sidewalks.
And that whole smartphone, everywhere. That whole smartphone revolution happened while you were in jail, right?
Yes. Yeah. So I was very unfamiliar with the change in culture. I mean, I had never imagined that you can even use Google Maps in Tehran, for instance, to find places, or any of these other practical apps that help you actually to live in a city, to find places, to discover new restaurants and
of course, the smartphone revolution also implies a social media revolution.
Yes, I knew Facebook before I came back to Iran and arrested. But I was only using it as a method for connecting to my friends, basically. But when I came out, I realized Facebook has become so huge that now it dominates the time that people spend online. And everything now is going through Facebook. It's become the biggest gateway for news and information for many, many people. And this was a huge surprise.
So as a blogger, how have you kind of molded yourself into that internet ecosystem now?
I think the biggest shift now with the social networks and smartphones is that basically web as the most dominant form or dominant technology that was using the infrastructure of the internet is now in decline. The web is basically dying as a result of social media and also smartphone apps.
I mean, if anything, since you've gotten out of prison, there are more apps than ever for communicating in social media. Do you think that Iran today is freer online than it's ever been.
In some ways, yes, and in some ways, no. The censorship has increased, but at the same time, access to the internet has also increased. So there are many, many more people connected to the internet as a whole in Iran. And they have access to some social networks, and they don't have to some others. For instance, Instagram and some of these chat platforms like Telegram are widely popular, and they're not blocked or censored. But, for instance, Twitter is, and Facebook is also blocked. But that doesn't stop people from accessing them. They use many different techniques to get around these filters. And I think when you see, for instance, the breadth of discussions and diversity of the opinions that are expressed on these social networks, even from within Iran, you would be surprised. It's not perfect, it's not ideally open, but it's still happening and it still exists.
Iranian blogger Hossein Darakhshan there. He's currently living in Tehran. Finally today, we still have not drained our supply of music from 2015. So much good stuff, not enough time. That's fine, though, because the next round of hot releases starts coming our way in February. In the meantime, here's a band that makes its home in two Canadian cities, Montreal and Winnipeg. Chic Gamine is the name, and that would be a tip to the French speakers of Montreal. Direct translation, classy lassie. Sorry, it does rhyme. It would be hard to tell, aside from their name, that they've got Quebec roots. Chic Gamine is all about female harmonies and original tunes, and all of the songs on their latest CD, Light a Match, offer those harmonies in English, except for one. Je tombe, where I fall, is an equal opportunity number in French and English. Thought at first you were fleeing from me. Maintenant je vois que c'est toi la commune. Your trail, your good friend. Disappear si je respire. Et moi en prie. And that's where we fall today. The world comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston. I'm Marco Werman, back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.